Senate Bill 76, and give Senator Morissette an opportunity to speak. I know he's probably got other busy schedules today. It seems like it's a big day today for some reason. So we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 76. Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Bill Morissette from Lane and Linn County, and with me today are several constituents who, on whose behalf I am introducing Senate Bill 76. Bob Cassidy, who is sitting directly behind me, will be following me in testimony concerning the bill. It was his request. Sitting to my left is former Senator Pete Sorensen, who is now a Lane County Commissioner. And next to Pete is Nancy Bray, who is an English language learner teacher in the Springfield District, who will also testify on behalf of this bill. This gives business owners, and many oftentimes small owners, the opportunity to help the people who work for them, and that includes high school students who want to go on and continue their education at the community college, and adults who are working for oftentimes a minimum wage for a small business owner who has a lot of compassion, can't afford to pay them more, but is looking for ways to help. And so this suggestion is to allow a total or partial tax credit for assisting students to continue their education under certain conditions. And I know that in times like this, it's probably is a difficult thing to consider, but it's an idea, I think, whose time has come and should at least be considered. And so with that, I would like Bob Cassidy to come forward and give you some compelling reasons why you should approve this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Bob, and introduce yourself.
I'm Bob Cassidy, and that's 1401 East 27th in Eugene. And with me is Nancy Gray and Pete Sorensen. I think we will have Nancy go first on your comments.
Introduce yourself.
Mm-hmm. My name is Nancy Bray. I live at 2155 Monroe Street in Eugene, Oregon, and I work as the English Language Learner Specialist in the Springfield School District. And I have a bad cold, so I hope that you can understand me. So, Senate Bill 76 is very important for the English language learners in the state of Oregon. And to put this into perspective, you might want to picture in your mind two English language learners who've just moved here to the state of Oregon. We'll call them Juan and Elena. And they've just moved here from Mexico and speak no English. They joined the 44,256 other English language learners already enrolled in ELL classes in public schools in our state. Well, there's been a lot of research on how long it takes to learn a second language. And this research shows that if Elena, who is literate in her native language, Spanish, it will take her 5 to 7 years to become literate in a second language. And Juan, on the other hand, let's say, is not literate in his native language. And research shows that it will take him 7 to 10 years to become literate in English. We are getting more and more students like Juan enrolling in our school district. These are students who've had little schooling in their native country. They're not literate in their native language, and they're overage for their grade level. If they move here when they're in elementary school, we have a good chance of helping them learn English, succeed in their academic classes, and go on to graduate from high school. If they move here in middle school, it's more difficult, but still with intensive instruction in English and academic support in their native language, we are able to help those students also to gain enough English and academic skills so that they can also graduate from high school. But if Juan and Elena move here when they're in high school, it's very difficult for them in the 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, maybe even only 1 year that they're enrolled in high school, for us to help them learn enough English in order to get enough high school credits to graduate. Research shows that it just does take a very long time to learn a second language. If you add to this the factor that many of these students need to work in order to support themselves and their families, we can understand why so many of them drop out of high school. In these economic times, every member of the family who is old enough to work is needed to in order to help the family survive. The Hispanic dropout rate in Oregon is 13.3%, over two times the state dropout rate. So over the course of the school year, approximately one in six Hispanic students drops out. For Oregon Hispanic students, the factors which affect their decision to drop out include does not speak English well or at all, and obligations to support family. What do Juan and Elena need after they drop out of school and find employment? They need the opportunity for more education, not less. They need the opportunity to improve their English skills and to learn skills which will help them in the workplace. Community colleges such as Lane Community College have excellent programs for students like Juan and Elena, programs which LCC has described in their letter to you. But Juan and Elena simply do not have the economic resources they need to be able to enroll in a community college. Even if they were to receive financial aid, they would still have to be employed while going to school. And what about our English language learners who do graduate from high school? How many of them go on to attend a community college or university? I don't have statewide statistics on this, but I can tell you about our students at Springfield High School. Last June, we had 10 English language learners graduate, 9 with a regular diploma and 1 with an adult basic ed diploma. Of those 10 students, 3 of them are now enrolled at Lane Community College. All of those 3 are working and going to school part-time. They are not able to take a full load of classes because they have to work, and it's not easy to fit their class schedule around their work schedule. The other 7 students are either working or looking for work. Attending community college is not an option for them because they do not have the money for tuition and books, and their entire salary is needed to support themselves or their families. Most of them hope to attend community college when they've been able to save up some money for expenses, but they do not see this as a possibility in the near future. Senate Bill 76 would make a big difference for students like these who've graduated from high school and for students like Juan and Elena who've dropped out. It would allow them the opportunity to get back into the educational system while they are employed. This will benefit all of us in Oregon because as they get more education, they will also improve their opportunities for employment and their ability to support themselves and their families. As you can see from the data on U.S. employment rates by educational attainment for Hispanic students age 16 and up. With more education and better employment, they will be contributing to our economy by paying higher taxes. Senate Bill 76 will open doors for our English language learners, and these are doors which are currently closed for them. Thank you.
Welcome.
Hi.
Back in front of it, huh?
Exactly. On the other side of the bar. My name is Pete Sorensen, and I'm a Lane County Commissioner. My address is 125 East 8th Avenue, Lane County Courthouse in Eugene. Lane County has been a county since 1851, making it older even than the state of Oregon. So I'm here, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to support Senate Bill 76, a bill which will establish a tax credit for employers who pay all or part of community college tuition for an employee. I come not as a member, as a Lane County Commissioner, although I am significantly involved in workforce matters in that position, and I come not as a member of the Lane Workforce Partnership Board of Directors, although that organization is significantly involved in the transition of high school students and dropouts into the workforce. And I come not as a former member of the Oregon State Senate, where all the members are concerned about Oregon's record high unemployment. And lastly, I come not as a member, former board member and chair of the board at Lane Community College. Rather, I'm coming today as a father and a grandson. My daughter works at Market of Choice, a local grocery store in Eugene, and attends Lane Community College, and her employer would be eligible for the tax credit under this bill. It would help her get through college and make her a better employee for the grocery store. I also come before you as the grandson of a sheep herder. My grandfather was a Danish immigrant and came to the U.S. without knowing the English language. He was befriended by a school superintendent who thought my grandfather had an aptitude for learning. The superintendent Lieutenant tutored my grandfather in the English language and helped him attain his high school diploma. That story alone might show that with a little help, more Americans could gain access to what our country has to offer, but the story doesn't end there. The superintendent of the little rural school district in northern Arizona didn't stop. He gave my grandfather the tremendous sum of $100, this being around World War I when a dollar went a lot further, and saw to that my grandfather went to college and medical school. The superintendent supported my grandfather and family while they were at UCLA, so after 50 years of practicing medicine in a rural community, that $100 went quite far and multiplied itself many times. Senate Bill 76 is a way to give a hand up, not a hand out, and I urge you to pass this important legislation. And my formal statement says, P.S., I don't miss being here, but I would like to add a few more remarks, and that is that you'll see the blanks in the bill. We included those blanks to be flexible about the difficulty that you're facing this session, and I'll give you a couple of round numbers to try to run a simulation at some point to see what the cost would be. And that is, if in line 10 you had $1,000 as the limit per employee, that would spread this money around so that employers could make it possible over the course of a calendar year or a tax year to spend $1,000 per employee. The other number I'll add there is a cap on the size of the business. And I chose 50 totally arbitrarily, and again, it's just a number to get the conversation moving. And another thing I'd like to point out is we have actually proposed in this bill, in our writing of this bill, that we start the bill, that we start the effect later. We actually want to start the credit later. And the reason we want to do that is, number one, that helps deal with your current fiscal problems. Number two, we think that if the legislation is passed, signed into law, that we'll have time then to have community colleges and employers learn about this, and then we can have a true measure of what the impact of this legislation is. So we're actually asking for the delay, and we're actually asking for the sunset. I can't say enough good about the people that have put a lot of work into this. And from a workforce perspective, we know that this kind of continued education and workforce development is really a very effective workforce. So I'll turn it back to Bob Cassidy, and he can give you the wrap-up.
Hey, Bob, please introduce yourself. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Bob Cassidy, 1401 East 27th in Eugene. I'm just a citizen at large, basically. I have talked to a number of people over the last number of years about this concept, and I'll give you a brief indication of that. President Spilley of Lane Community College and Kate Berry, the women's program, Sandy Cutler and Jim Lindley of representing small businesses from Lane Community College, J.L. Wilson, National Federation of Independent Businesses, Harry Matthews, the Association of Oregon Industries, the Oregon Restaurant Association, the Oregon Center for Public Policy, David Butler of OSU, a number of small business people in town, many other people, and all have responded with very positive responses on this. A few years ago, I had picked up a copy of Poverty in Oregon put out by the Extension Service at OSU. You're probably familiar with it. I was struck by the continued reference to the people in poverty being caught in a box. One after another, the articles were using that phrase, that they were trapped. They just seemed to couldn't get out of it. One of the many elements that kept reoccurring in the articles was the need for education as a way to get out of the box. And I remember my own years of not wanting to go back to school after my Army duty was finished. I wasn't a good student in high school, but it was paid for by the GI Bill, and it made all the difference in my life. The effect of this bill will enable primarily small business owners who currently hire most of the low-wage earners to select and encourage promising candidates to go back to school and try to improve themselves with further education. They offer the tuition, to pay for the tuition, arrange for the school hours if needed, and give them encouragement. That relationship between the employer and the employee, I think, is really needed here. And this is at no significant cost to the businesses. It's not the answer for all low-wage workers, of course. Not all are cut out to return to school. But the education of these selected few could keep that many more out of future poverty. There is a cost to the state, of course. The cost would vary depending upon whether these students take credit courses or non-credit courses, such as English as a second language. I'm estimating that maybe 5% of the approximate 100,000 people that are minimum wage earners might seek this opportunity. And I'm told by wiser people like the Federation of Independent Businesses and others that this is quite optimistic. But on that basis, if 5%, including the cost of books, the cost may be about $1.5 million a year. If they took non-credit courses, that would be less. It'd be less than $1 million. And this, of course, will be something for the Revenue Committee to examine closely. But I'd like to recommend your approval of the bill, accompanied with a couple of recommendations. That it does include the cost of books, which is almost half of the cost. The effective year of the three-year bill be 05 instead of 04, so it'd go 05, 06, and 07. If we're going, this is going to sunset, and if we want to get good records for the first year, we want to have a good participation in it so we can see how many people are actually using this. And we won't get the records until the following year when the tax credits come in, and then they've got to be compiled and brought back to you for reviewing this bill. And that the eligibility wage of the employee be set at the amount of about 50 cents above the current minimum wage in the state. And that's item 3B of the bill, the blank, the bottom blank on that one. The other two items are the limitations on total credits available. And in thinking about this, I suspect with small businesses, not more than one or two people would be eligible at any one time. It's a matter of arranging school hours and that sort of thing. If so, this could be expanded. If they do want to send more, it could be expanded in the future to include more benefits for the businesses. Thank you.
Any good questions of the panel? Yeah, Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Mr. Cassidy, first of all, thank you for your interest in this, and I think certainly getting more and more people into the educational system is ultimately a benefit for all. I had a couple of questions, though, on your testimony. In terms of the cost of the state, you mentioned it would vary whether they took credit courses or non-credit courses. I was just trying to, there's nothing in the bill about that, and so I was wondering what the, if this was something that was yet to come, or I get a nod from the commissioner.
No. Senator Nelson and Senator Metzger, the choice of the classes that they take is not something that's dictated by the employer. It's their own choice, something that they would be interested in taking. It's a matter of getting that first step on the ladder back into the school, and if they're successful, getting the encouragement of the counselors at the school to go on an education, much like the superintendent did with Mr. Sorensen's grandfather. The choices that they make, the non-credit courses with their cost of books are almost half of the cost, a little bit more than half of the cost of a credit course. Did I answer your question?
Well, I was thinking more of in terms of, were you expecting a policy decision of whether a course would be eligible based on leading to some type of degree or just woodworking class, or if you had a, that's what I was trying to get to.
No.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, my view is that we would be best to not change the bill, that the concept is a tax credit for tuition, and that the educational policy people at Lane Community College have taken a look at this, counseled against doing that because the learner is going to be at various levels. And if you limited it to non-credit, you would be excluding credit. If you limited it to non-credit, you'd be excluding non-credit. So our point is that a lot of these people are coming into the educational system, and it's not appropriate for them to be taking yet credit. And that's good for the Oregon taxpayer because the cost of this whole tax credit will be lower because a lot of those people will be entering and they'll be taking the non-credit courses, which will be a lot less money. So we don't want to limit the bill to credit or non-credit. We want to leave that up to the learner.
Mr. Chair, can I continue?
Yes, Senator.
Another question too, and Mr. Commissioner, I mean, we're talking about businesses who have taxes otherwise due, and so if an employee of such a business were to pay for schooling of this nature, that would be a business expense and would be currently deductible already under Oregon law. Would that not be correct?
Somewhat, Mr. Metzger, Senator Metzger, if it's in line with that current business, it's improving that business. Other than English as a second language, it's kind of back and forth between both things. But if he's sending for a training for his business, that is a tax deduction. Mm-hmm. And this is a little bit different. This is something. You don't have to train them in school to flip hamburgers. We're talking about low-wage workers that aren't really going for skills. This is an attempt to get them to go for a real job, to get back in school in the education environment, to do something that they're interested in. Maybe it's an art program, and they just do the flipping of hamburgers for getting that far. But it's to try to improve the person. Mm-hmm. I'm not making myself clear.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, my response to that is that in the case of, say, a small business, like the sandwich shop that Mr. Cassidy ran or the small law firm I ran, the present Oregon tax code would allow the employer to deduct from their income the expenses where the employer chose the educational path or seminar or program or continued education, but only if it led to an improvement of their work for that particular employer. Okay? What we are trying to do with this bill is broaden that concept to a group of employers who have a tremendously difficult time, but they're the people that are employing the people that need more formal education, that need more skills in learning English language, that need more arithmetic skills, that need more general development in their education. We're trying to balance that against what the tremendous cost would be if we just opened that up to an unlimited amount of tax credit. So we're suggesting a limit, but our idea is that this engages the learner on what the learner wants to do and how we get them involved in their own education and development. So yes, we currently have that deduction, but if my legal secretary had the aptitude to become a lawyer, I could only get a deduction for her to become a better legal secretary. I could not get a deduction as a lawyer running a law office for her to take a college preparatory course to see if she had the aptitude to go on. So that, I think, is the distinction. And I think this bill has this tremendous idea of self-improvement, of people taking personal responsibility for where they are and how they can improve themselves wherever they are. And I think it really is a way to take that employer that wants to help that employee and make the education possible, because we know everyone's a lifelong learner. You know, everyone's got that potential, and we might as well try to trade on Oregon's reputation as having a reasonably highly trained workforce, and try to bring up the rest of the people that are mentioned in that poverty report that don't have that skill right now. So that's the idea.
Mr. Cassidy, you had a thought there that you wanted to express?
Just a thought that it's a very select group that we're after.
Any further questions from the committee? Okay, good. Well, thank you. Thank you all for coming for testifying. Appreciate it. You guys did a good job. So this thing indicates that it may have a revenue impact, but we had no statement that's been issued to us yet. And we have been asked to refer this to the Revenue Committee, and I suppose there's a potential referral to Ways and Means someplace down the line, depending on what they would do. So what I would propose is to close the public hearing, open up a work session, and move it to Revenue Committee without the recommendation. Is there any discussion along those lines?
Well, there's amendments they wanted to make to the bill anyway, so I can get those made.
Yeah, they can get those.
While it's making its way over the revenue.
Okay. If anything, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 76 and open up a work session. And the chair would move that the Senate Bill 76 be referred to the Committee on Revenue. At this point, without any recommendation, and is there any questions or objections to that? If there's none, so moved, and we will send that bill to Revenue, and you can continue on with this process, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
thank you.
I want to thank all of them, especially Mr. Cassidy. He's worked very hard on this bill for several months.
Coming up
years.
Years. Months that I've seen you. Years for you.
A long way back.
Very good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. So we close the public hearing. Go back to Senate Bill 56 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 56. And this is another bill that the chair, when he first came to us, we thought that it was a bill that was going to create a whole new panel, but evidently it is. Well, Dennis, why don't you explain it? Why don't you explain it?
Okay. Senate Bill 56 creates an advisory committee with responsibility to develop recommendations for the promotion of financial education that leads to financial self-sufficiency.
And my understanding of this is going to create a whole new body, but evidently there's been work done in the interim on this particular thing. It's gone to the Health and Human Resources Committee. And Senator Fisher has been doing some work on this, and so he came to me and asked me if I would just refer it to his committee without any recommendation for him to handle it. So is there any discussion along those lines?
Well, Mr. Chair,
yes.
This sounds like a bill about how to stay away from the payday lender and the car title lender.
So you want it in there?
I kind of want to follow this one.
Okay. I'm sure Senator Fisher will do that, but the chair would move that we refer Senate Bill 56 to the to Senator Fisher's Committee on Health and Human Resource without any recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered, and we'll close the public hearing, or the work session on Senate Bill 56, open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 109. And Dennis, would you like to discuss?
Senate Bill 109 extends provisions of home solicitation sales statutes to include sales conducted in temporary locations such as hotel or motel, convention center, restaurant, fairgrounds, or dormitory lounge. Raises the Oregon standard to those imposed by the Federal Trade Commission. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
All right. Well, we've got some folks from the Department of Justice here. Welcome, and please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. My current assignment is as Attorney in Charge of the Department's Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Roth, also Assistant Attorney General, working in this section that Cheryl supervises.
Thank you.
How I would propose to do this is that I'll lead off, make some general comments about the bill. I would note that Mr. Roth is this bill's main architect, and he worked on it both last session and this session. So if the committee has any specific or technical questions, I would probably defer to Mr. Roth in that regard. As Mr. Dotson pointed out in his summary, what Senate Bill 109 does is it simply conforms our existing Home Solicitations Act or law to the Federal Trade Commission's three-day cooling off rule. In 1995, the Federal Trade Commission expanded its rule to cover sales that occur at places other than the seller's regular place of business. Originally, this both the Oregon law and the Federal Trade Commission rule covered door-to-door sales. And what it was designed to guard against was what we call ambush sales, where someone shows up at a person's doorstep with a good for sale, corners the person in their own house, and then uses high-pressure sales tactics to sell the person goods, leaves, person usually is left with something other than what they thought they purchased, and with no remedy. In 1995, as I said, the Federal Trade Commission held a series of hearings, found that the rule should be amended because at that time these sorts of ambush sales were occurring at more than consumers' houses. They had expanded and they were now occurring at restaurants and fairs and motel rooms. So the Federal Trade Commission amended its law, and it also noted in its rule that to the extent any state law provides less protection than the federal rule, it is preempted. So it is that section of the FTC rule that brings us here today. What we seek to do is to simply expand Oregon law to meet the breadth of the Federal Trade Commission's rule, and to ensure that it is enforceable in Oregon by Oregon consumers. And I would note in that regard that the Oregon law contains a provision in Section 3 of the bill, which essentially says that unless and until a seller provides notice, as required by the law, that the buyer can cancel at any time. And that remedy is unique to Oregon law. That is not contained in the Federal Trade Commission rule.
Would that change that then?
No, it would not, Mr. Chair. It would preserve it.
Preserve it.
Yes. And I would note also that as a result of Mr. Roth's work last session and our work with certain interest groups that we have built in, there is an exemption. The financial institutions were concerned about ATM machines. I would note there's a specific exclusion in there which makes clear that this is not intended to cover transactions at ATMs to the extent that they're considered to be a place other than the regular place of business of the seller. If the committee has any questions.
Let me just when you said that, I had a constituent who had a complaint about an ATM machine, and he was saying how bad the law was. But I understood actually Oregon law is pretty good with ATM machines.
I think so, Mr. Chair. I mean, they're essentially just an extension of a bank, so you would deal with either the bank that was providing the service or your own bank that was.
Federal law is involved there, I think, as I understand it.
Yes, if it's a federally chartered institution, it would be the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Do you want to add anything to this?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think it might help to say, since I know you've got a lot on your plate, that there's in a sense less here than meets the eye because you have four pages of text, but the core of the change is just what's indicated in the first few lines, where what we now have in Oregon law is sales at a residence other than that of the seller. That's what the legislature passed in 1971, and it's just to get away from that concept of residence and put it in other contexts where these sales are now made. That's what the whole rest of it is about. And so the first few lines there talk about hotel, motel rooms. If you wonder how does somebody end up in one of those, you know, a couple guys are going to a town and look at the records, come up with everybody who's been married or had a baby in the last 6 months, send out 500 postcards, come and pick up your prize at the motel for, you know, congratulations. People go there and now they're confronted. And what you're dealing with is unsophisticated consumer and people who are trained to do this and do it for a career and know a lot of tricks to get people to buy things. So that's the guts of what it's about. And it's really a little simpler maybe than it looks with all this text. The rest of it just kind of plays out the details.
Questions? Yes, Senator Roth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know, maybe you discussed it when I had to step out. I thought I remembered this bill from last session in my Smart Growth and Commerce Committee on the House side. And if I'm tracking what happened to it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, you're correct. This was, I believe, that was Representative Witt's committee. You were on it as well.
Basement.
Yeah, here in Room 50. And this bill did pass out of that. Actually, most of the work on the bill last session was completed on the House side. That was where we worked with the banking community and some other interest groups. It did pass out, and I believe it died in the Senate.
It passed the House unanimously.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Right. I think we just ran out of time.
It was just the Senate who held it up, huh?
Yeah,
by gosh. All righty.
Any further questions of the witnesses? Any questions? What about a half an hour before the hearing, a representative of the Automobile Association came and said, well, I might have some problems with this. And so I said, what I'd have him do is get together with you guys, and you can look at the language, and we can see what's. And I don't know exactly what the specifics were.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe that was Mr. Fuller.
Yes.
And he was concerned about Girl Scout cookies, whether or not this would ban the sales of Girl Scout cookies. And we we don't believe it would for a couple of reasons. One, I think he has a personal interest in that.
Yeah. Two kids, wife, or a boy.
First, that this does not apply for sales for cash or check in the amounts of less than $25. And equally important, in order to take advantage of this law's remedies, you have to return the goods in the same condition that you bought them.
Okay. Okay. Problem.
I think those s'mores will be disappearing.
Just because he asked me to hold that off, what we'll do is we'll just shut the public hearing and make sure that that's exactly what he wants or what he has in mind. Maybe there was something else that that he didn't tell you or didn't tell me. So
okay.
We'll plan to keep this in play, and so we'll know where we're at. But just take care of everybody's interests and concerns.
Thank you very much.
Girl Scouts or not. Okay. We'll
thank you
shut the public hearing and you guys get together, and I'll talk with Daryl Fuller at some point or another and see what we're at, so we're around this thing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You.
Hey, open up public hearing now on Senate Bill 121. Mr. Dotson.
Senate Bill 121 authorizes the Oregon Attorney General to create a registry of electronic mail addresses requesting not to receive unsolicited electronic mail, better known as spam. Enforceable under state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act and a fine up to $25,000 declares an emergency effective on passage. No revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact, no statement issued.
Hey, Cheryl, hello again.
Hello. Everyone with me?
Welcome again. Please introduce yourself again.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, assigned as Attorney in Charge of the Department's Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 121. It is the bill introduced by Attorney General Myers, and it targets spam, which is unsolicited commercial bulk email. I believe that y'all have just been provided with the department's written testimony. I'm not going to go through it line by line. I'll just make a couple of points from there. That spam is a problem to both businesses and consumers. For consumers, what we've seen is that it's a very popular way to distribute or solicit participation in activities that are illegal in Oregon. Spam is a real common way of soliciting participation, for example, in pyramid or gift clubs, which are made unlawful under the state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. We've also seen it used to solicit participation in bogus multi-level marketing schemes, get-rich-quick or business opportunities, offer products and services including pornographic materials and websites. Spam causes problems, legitimate or not, for both consumers and businesses because it shifts the cost. The way that spam is set up and transmitted, the cost of spam is actually borne by the recipients, not the senders. And that cost is both in terms of convenience, but it's also an economic cost. Spam is one of the major carriers of computer viruses. Spam, the internet service providers experience difficulties with spams, as do companies that have their own networks, because spam clogs networks with excess traffic, slows transmission times, it's caused systems to crash, it imposes additional costs on businesses as they have to buy filtering software, bigger and faster servers, add more staff in order to manage the additional software. There's a consulting firm, Meta Group, that expects that most companies spend between $7 to $10 per year per user in buying and utilizing spam-blocking software and employing staff to operate and maintain that software. We also believe that spam presents a threat to privacy. There's the obvious intrusion into your home of unwanted email, but in addition, there are spam messages that contain a feature that what happens is when the spam is sent to your computer and you open it up, there's a feature in that message that goes into the directory of which your email is a member and harvests all of the other emails in that directory and sends it back to the sender. So then the sender has an entire new list of addresses that are good addresses that it can use and that it can sell, because that's another thing that spammers do is they collect addresses and then they sell them. As far as what's being done currently to address spam, I am sorry to say that what we have available to us is very limited at this point. If spam is used to solicit participation in some activity that's barred under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, we can pursue the sender. Or if the content of the spams is deceptive or otherwise violates the law, we can go after the sender, but it's on a case-by-case basis. If it's otherwise lawful, there's essentially nothing that we can do, and there's no tool that we can give to citizens to allow them to cut down on the incidence of spam. That's what Senate Bill 121 would do, and it's set up on the model of Oregon's no-call list. And that was actually first enacted in 1989 as a black dot law. It was amended in 1999 to create the list concept. It's been very, very popular. In Oregon, there are currently over 110,000 citizens that have signed up for the no-call law. Every time they re-up for another year, they tell us that it has been successful in blocking not all, but the vast majority of unwanted telephone solicitation. So based on that model, we're hopeful that a no-spam list, like the no-call law, would give citizens a way to decrease the amount of unwanted commercial email that they receive in their homes. That's about all I have initially. Unless you want to get down into specifics of the bill, how it would work. It contemplates that the Attorney General would enter into a contract with a private list administrator. That list administrator would be responsible for collecting emails from people who wanted to sign up and then making a list available over the internet basically to anybody that was going to send spam into Oregon. And what that really means is that anybody that is engaged in the business of sending commercial bulk email would have to get the Oregon list before they sent their email out or risk being in violation of our law. It would give the Attorney General the authority to enforce the provisions by making a violation of this law a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. What that means in practice, just like with the no-call law, is if We received a number of complaints from consumers whose email addresses were on the list. We would screen to make sure that an exemption didn't apply, and I think there are only a couple of exemptions in the no-spam list. And if the spammer had violated the list, then we would take action against them. And I can say that, you know, just as with telemarketers, I think that there's somewhat of a perception that the vast majority of people who spam are like somewhere in other parts of the world other than the United States, and we're just not sure that that's so. There are a number of spammers that are located in the continental U.S. and are easily within the grasp of our jurisdiction. So we believe it would be a very effective way, has no fiscal impact, because it contemplates that the list administrator, through collection of fees from both people that want to sign up for the list and spam, and people who want to send spam into Oregon, would generate enough revenue to run the program. So we wouldn't be paying out anything for it.
Our report says may have a fiscal impact, but no statements yet issued, so it may or may not.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that to the extent it would have a fiscal impact, that would be the administrative cost of the Department of Justice to set the program up.
So. Question, Senator Metzger?
Yeah, Senator Nelson, as I was looking through the bill earlier, and I have a bill in Senate Judiciary that's going to be heard in a couple of weeks that deals with a couple of issues that this bill does not. And I'd like to ask your opinion on those issues, and I certainly would be happy to incorporate them rather than more efficiency. But a number of businesses in my district who brought this issue forth to me on email considered two things. Number one, under the unlawful trade practices, was A, to make it an unlawful trade practice to misrepresent the identity of the sender. And what has happened, Mr. Chair, and I say that wasn't covered in your bill that I had put in the other one, was a business, Cascade Property Management, which does vacation rentals at Mount Hood. Someone had appropriated basically got their list and had an email that looked like it was from them. And because it went to their list and they would open it and it was porn. And of course they would get calls back saying, what's this? And then there was a little dot or something a little different. And it really is not good for business to have people misappropriate the intent of your name. And then the second aspect of that, which also wasn't covered here, was to make it an unlawful trade practice if you cannot easily identify a return address to the sender. And I think we've had that experience where you've gotten something in your business and you email and say, you know, don't do this to me anymore, or whatever, and it comes back undeliverable because they have blocked the identity of the person or business or whoever that sent that to you. And it would cover both of those things, is to make sure that, A, your identity is clear, and that there is a way to contact the person who, or organization that sent you that email. I would be interested in your response on that, because we do have that one coming up, and if the Attorney General is interested in that, Mr. Chamoff wrote, I would be interested maybe in consolidating those.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, the bill that you described, I believe that your bill is similar to bills that have been introduced and passed in a number of other states where they require, like, it's truth in, you know, advertising. If it's an advertisement, it has to say that, or the subject line has to identify accurately the content. And there, at least in our review of recent decisions under the Oregon Constitution, we have some concerns about a bill that might be construed to restrict content of a communication. And I confess that I haven't looked at
your
Mr. bill.
Chair, I don't think you've read this bill then.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with content. It's very clear about the identity cannot be deliberately misrepresented, and you have to have an ability to reply to the sender. It has nothing to deal with the content. What has happened is that the content that you would not necessarily desire ends up in that envelope. But it's misrepresenting both who you are. If it's Ron Tonkin Dodge, and you're not really Ron Tonkin Dodge, and you got their mail list and you sent them things you didn't want. And secondly, to be able to make sure that when you have received that solicitation, that you have an access to return to contact that individual, rather than have that be disguised.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, a little further. To the extent that it it prohibits misrepresentations. That you're right, that would be consistent with what the Unlawful Trade Practices Act currently says. There's a provision, I don't know if it's 608, 646, 608, 1A or B, that prohibits misrepresentations about the source of goods or services. So that's sort of like what you're talking about in the subject line header or the return address. I think Senate Bill 121 is maybe just a different platform for getting at the same issue, insofar as it would allow a person to just, by putting an address on the list, say, you know, I don't really care who it's from or whether or not it's legitimate or not. I just don't want to receive it, unless if it's from a sender with whom I have no current relationship. But we would be happy to look at your bill and to see if there's a way to blend
that. I'd be interested, Mr. Chair, in talking to the Attorney General and Mr. Chamberlain about that.
Sure.
Any further questions? Ms. Witness?
Just one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cheryl, I understood that if this comes from overseas, there's not anything you can do about it. Isn't that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, not necessarily. And we don't have a law like this that addresses spam, but I can tell you that take our unsolicited fax law, mm-hmm. which prohibits, it's like a don't fax me again. We had a company that was based in England that was generating unsolicited faxes. In fact, the city of Pendleton, I think that they received, I don't know, a whole slew of them within a few month period, and it jammed their fax machines. They complained to us. They were using a fax blaster here in Florida, but we successfully sued the company in England and received a judgment. They appeared in Oregon and through an attorney, and they signed a stipulated judgment, and they agreed to go out of business in the state. So if we can find them, and if it's a country, for example, that we have a treaty with that allows for service in that country, then I think that we have a shot at getting them. Now, identifying the source in the first place, I think, is probably going to be the greatest challenge for us. And I brought this stack of paper. This is about 500 emails that came to our consumer hotline email address in one day, on January 15th. And all of the return addresses are different, but it's the same sender. And our information services, they had us print them all out, and they looked at them, and they determined the location of the sender. But it took a while, and they were using a number of different ISPs. It was very difficult for them to track, but we were able to do it. So I think that I wouldn't say that we couldn't reach them.
Well, I'd sure like you to find the prince or whomever, Prince Mubaba or whatever, keeps asking me to send him money for his country or his mother or whatever.
That's the Nigerian partnership.
Yeah, the Nigerian.
Yeah, there.
So if you can do that in this bill, I'm there.
That person takes many different forms of
iteration. Any further questions?
No.
Oh, okay, thank you, Cheryl. We have some other witnesses here. So.
Thank you very much.
We might. We have a room full.
Yeah, Brad Wolf and Jim Cravens, please.
And could I just say, Mr. Chair, sure. If the committee members have any questions for me at the conclusion of others' testimony, I'd be happy to try to answer any issues that are raised.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Hey,
let's see. Yeah, you were signed up first. Please, introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Chairman Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. I have no written testimony. I'm just here to testify in support of Senate Bill 121. Many of our small company members are ISP providers as well, or have subsidiary ISP operations. We see Senate Bill 121, the creation of a no spam list, is a remedy to an annoying and potentially costly situation. And as the administrator of the Oregon No Call Program, I can testify to the the success of that particular program and how that's helped us answer consumer complaints in regards to unwanted telemarketer calls. And if we can do the same thing with unwanted email solicitations, we're happy to be supportive of that particular endeavor. And that's all the testimony I had.
Okay, any questions? Mr. Craven.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven, representing the American Electronics Association. We're a national trade association, the largest U.S. group representing the technology industry. And among some of our larger members are the two largest Internet service providers in the United States, America Online and Microsoft. So just in the interest of disclosure, I want to begin by stipulating nearly all of the Attorney General's concern about this issue. And I don't think there's anybody in this building representing slimy spammers. Some of us, though, have some issues with the specific bill. And so I think that's what most of the people in this building may bring you some differences of opinion on the best way to address an issue, but agreeing that this is a real-life issue and of deep concern to many people is something I think we all share. For most consumers, unsolicited commercial email or spam, is at best a minor annoyance. It is sometimes inappropriate material, so it moves above the level of being an annoyance to being, a concern for families, and especially some of the sleazier stuff that children have been known to get. It's more than just an annoyance. It's more than just hit the delete key. It's a issue for families and such. For the industry, and particularly for the ISP community, it is a major cost. And I think some of that was touched on in Cheryl's testimony. America Online estimates that about 40% of its email traffic is unsolicited commercial email. And that's not because America Online is out there in the business of giving away your address or selling them for commercial purposes. It's people who so-called harvest addresses through all kinds of pretty slick techniques go in there and grab your email from various sources, commercial, non-commercial, chat rooms, all kinds of ways people have of getting that address for you, of you, and it usually is not your ISP giving it away. Unless, of course, you list your address in a public directory, and in case you kind of get what you deserve. You got to remember to click that little box that says, don't list my email in a public directory. That helps a little bit. But I think from legitimate commercial solicitors and commercial solicitations, still legal in this country, they have a concern about not wanting to be thrown in the mix with everybody else. And the ISP community doesn't want their customers to believe that they're giving away your address and that they are the source of your unsolicited commercial email. So it's a multi-million dollar problem even just for the ISP community themselves, and it's at least an annoyance or annoyance plus for everybody else. So my point in that big, long, stipulated opening is that, this isn't an issue of black and white or good guys and bad guys. It's a lot of good guys, I think, trying to find out the best solution to an issue. And about 4 years ago, our industry was pretty flat out against all state-by-state regulations of anything to do with the Internet. We saw it as an emerging technology that needed some time to become mature, that needed a chance to get its legs before we started seeing 50 state treatments of everything regulating the Internet. Since that time, something like 25 states have passed spam bills, unsolicited commercial email bills. And here's where we're going to get into some of the issues that Senator Metzger raised. In those 24 some odd states, there's a commonality of approach that almost makes us to close to a de facto national standard on legislation on this issue. They're not all exactly the same, but they are pretty similar, and they all have at least, most of them have at least four elements. One is the issue Senator Metzger raised, prohibiting falsification of a domain name or abduction of someone else's domain name or falsifying of header information or router information such that it's hard for the Attorney General to go even find who did it. And that's sort of a fraud statute. That's lying, that's cheating, that's stealing somebody else's property. Second, many of the states have a subject line regulation that says you have to start a commercial email with usually the letters ADV for advertisement, so that if you're doing this unsolicited commercial email, you have to, it has to say ad on it. So it makes it easier to delete them, makes it easier to block and filter them. You can set up your email to say, don't deliver anything with ADV in it, and you get rid of a lot of the stuff. Third, most states have required a clear opt-out provisions. Again, an issue that Senator Metzger raised. A clear way so you can call, write, or email the sender and say, please take me off the list. Most anti-spam activists will tell you, don't do that today. Don't reply to the email, because it just lets the person who sent it to you know that you're alive and real and that email's still good. Best way is just to delete it without trying to say, take me off your list. As outraged as you might be, best thing to do is just delete the email at the current time. And finally, most of the state bills have a provision that provides liability shields for the ISP community themselves in two different ways. One, that the ISP, just because they moved an email message from party A to party B, are not liable as a spammer themselves. I mean, people, they don't want the stuff going through their network, but people have lots of clever ways to push it through. Most ISPs want some liability that they don't get wrapped up in unfair trade practices and $25,000 a day penalties. The other issue that many states have addressed on behalf of the ISP community is an issue of, you know, a lot of AOL and Microsoft, they're aggressively going after these people on behalf of their customers. They want liability that says if they inadvertently delete an email that you might have wanted from, well, let's not name the source, that they have certain liability shield for good faith efforts to try to block spam. So that's something important to that community also. When the AG's bill approach came out, it was differing, you know, very much from the other two dozen states, which have these sort of common elements. I mean, we sat down with Cheryl and her staff and said, you know, why are we going down a no-call approach, which doesn't exist in the United States as far as email? And the answer, as you heard, a piece of it was, well, Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution is very robust, commercial free speech rules, probably more robust than most other states. And that would be subject to a constitutional challenge if we did what most of the other states have done. Now, I didn't go to law school, and so I'm not going to opine on whether that's the right legal analysis or not, but some of national attorneys have emailed me saying, well, if that's an impediment to do these fairly modest rules, don't lie in your subject line, give people a way to get off your list, if that's impermissible regulation of commercial speech, then a no-call list, which says you can't speak at all to the following list of people, why is that different? And we still, I think, want to have that conversation and have some lawyers do some lawyering around that, because it's a key topic. Fundamentally, what we would like, now that we've got 24-some-odd states going down a fairly similar path, and we hope Congress eventually will basically take those common ideas and do something nationally, and then we'll have one set of rules for the United States. We're quite frankly a little nervous about opening up a whole new direction of going down no-call list when most, you know, legitimate companies are still trying to comply with 25 states, including California, so certainly more than half the population. And there's some legal cases going through sort of saying that that's probably okay and meets legal tests. To start off on a whole new direction, we're a little concerned. Our preference would be conformity with the other states. We do have a bit of a concern of over-promising this as a solution, because I think the best solution, you know, to this issue is working aggressively with your ISP, many of whom offer very effective blocking, filtering types of email. I was just looking at MSN this morning. If you can just click it to say, I don't want email from anybody who's not on my own address book, and they will attempt to do their best to block everything for you. I mean, there's a lot of these tools out there. I think consumer education is very important. Educating consumers of don't throw your email around, don't use it in chat rooms, you know, don't list it in public directories. There's a lot of things we can do as individuals to minimize, not to get rid of this stuff, because the people that send it are pretty darn clever. And which kind of gets to that final point of by doing a no-call list, which we would hope would be respected by legitimate solicitors, do you do really anything about the Nigerian financial scam, the Britney Spears photographs, the liquid Viagra, and all that other stuff that we're getting? You got to sort of make some assumptions about who those people are and how interested they are in consulting Oregon's no-call list, purchasing it for a price, and promising to do no harm. Now, the enforcement would probably be a, you know, multiple offenses go after people on a selective basis, and that will probably have some, on a selective basis, get after some people. But whether that puts a big new barrier up in front of the legitimate people while maybe not really getting at the sleazeballs that we're trying to get at, that's a dialogue we're still having as far as the best approach in this bill. Finally, I just want to mention a couple of specifics in the bill just on the record, and I didn't have a chance to. I will get this to your committee administrator. It assumes on the bill, and you don't have to walk through all these, but page 1, line 12, talks about a party making a donation. So my assumption is that this covers nonprofit community, also would cover political solicitations, I would guess, and anything else. So there's a pretty broad net being cast here. On line 25, page 1, it talks about a person with an email address on a computer in this state. We're still not exactly sure what that phrase means. Well, we're not going to figure it out here, but that's just something that we're still working on. And page 2 in the top line 3, I know it was the Attorney General's effort to provide a shield here for ISPs. We're not certain this language does it, because it talks about a person who provides Internet access is not covered unless the person knows or has reason to know that a person's using the access to engage in spamming. Well, a lot of ISPs know who some of these people are, and every day they're in war trying to block them. You could see a situation where they would know that a person is using their system, they haven't been able to get rid of them. I don't think that's the intent, but again, that language needs some looking at, I think, to make sure that it's where we really want to go. So we would appreciate the opportunity to engage in some further conversations with the AG's office. I think Senator Metzger, on a totally different track, hit 2 of the 4 elements that are common to the other state laws around the country. I guess before we decide to go down a totally new route, we would like a little more chewing on, is it really impossible for Oregon to do what most of the other states have done? And then we'd be in conformity with the other states rather than launching down a whole new path. So that's our testimony, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jim. Is there anything going on in the House? Is there a similar bill in the House that you're aware of?
I don't think that I've seen one yet, Senator.
Just basically in the Senate at this point. Questions? Senator Weiger?
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry if I could correct that. Senator Representative Merkley will likely drop a bill. He hasn't done it to date, but I know he's working on it.
Senator Weiger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Craven, I just have a smidge of a problem, because in your testimony you said 4 years ago your industry was opposed to state-by-state regulations, so Oregon didn't do anything, and now here we are at the tail end again. 25 other states have done something, and now you're asking us to wait again. So how much longer do you want us to wait? How aggressive are you going to work on this with the AG's office, because I want something to come out this session. I don't think we need to wait another session.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I didn't suggest that we wait. I suggested that we are ready today to craft a bill that conforms with the basic trend around the United States. I have full authorization to work on a bill that has those common elements of misappropriation of domain names, fair disclosure in subject lines, opt-out opportunity. We're ready to do that. If the only thing standing in our way is Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, then again, if that becomes an absolute roadblock, then we'll have to, reboot a little bit. But, we're prepared today to support a spam law in Oregon, so I don't want to leave any other impression than that. We have our preferences of how it would be, and Senator Metzger had to step out, but those two elements and other elements that are contained in your bill are common features that we would support in a broader statewide bill. So.
Oh,
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman.
We have Jim Gardner and is it John?
Gotts.
G-O-T-T-S. Thank you. Please come up.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Gardner with the law firm of Gardner & Gardner, and I'm appearing today on behalf of Microsoft. I would echo basically everything that Jim Craven said and also try to convey to you a sense that this is a, as I mentioned in our meeting with Ms. Pellegrino in the AG's office, we're on the same side. The ISPs, particularly the larger ISPs, see this as a huge problem in terms of their customer base. They also see it as a cost driver because it uses up server time and server space. So we want to get at this problem. This bill, as drafted, for the reasons that that Mr. Craven mentioned, we think has some flaws. We would like to continue to work with the Attorney General and try to resolve first that basic Article 1, Section 8 issue, which we have a different view of. Our view is that the disclosure requirements that would be mandated by an approach similar to Mr. Craven's preferred approach are far less susceptible to Article 1, Section 8 challenge than what amounts to a prior restraint regime, which would be overbroad in the sense of reaching not merely commercial solicitation, but core speech activities in a non-commercial context. When you read the, as Mr. Craven mentioned, the language of encouraging a party to make a donation, that's not limited to a commercial setting. So we think there are flaws, technical flaws in this bill, and we think that the Article 1, Section 8 problems that may exist with regard to full disclosure are far less serious problems than the prior restraint problems that, that this bill represents. The other thing that I want to mention is that success on the part of the ISPs in screening out spam is clearly a source of competitive advantage. And these people are in intense competition with one another. And if one can do a better job of screening out the unwanted spam than the other, then that, that company gets an advantage. And both AOL and Microsoft are in heated competition as to who can do the best job technologically to screen this stuff out. And so I think maybe the one approach, the approach that we would advocate, is how can you work with the private sector with the kind of bill that Mr. Craven mentioned that has a liability shield in it to allow us to do the best possible job technologically to accomplish the result I think that all of us want to accomplish. One of the advantages that the ISPs have, frankly, is that they're not government, and thus they're not subject to the First Amendment, the free speech guarantees of Article 1, Section 8. So we can be more draconian, if you will, more strict in terms of screening out the spam than the Attorney General can be. And we intend to do just that with your help.
Okay. Okay. Any questions? John.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for an opportunity to speak. My name is John Gotts, and I have an anti-spam software company located here in Portland. And we're well aware of the problem that spam's creating, and I think that the opt-out list is a start, but it's absolutely not going to be any kind of a solution, not short-term, not long-term. Senator Metzger mentioned that a bad address of a sender, make that unlawful. Well, most... And someone else said when you hit reply, it says the person's not even there. In fact, all they do now know is that you do exist. You don't know where they are. How do you track them down? And if there's no fiscal responsibility on the part of the state to track these people down, who is going to come up with the money to track these people down? And, yeah, maybe you'll find somebody in Florida, but maybe you won't. Maybe they'll grab a Hotmail address or an HTTPI address, and they'll buy $200 worth of spam sending software, which will come, by the way, with 33 million email addresses ready for you to manage and use. And you push go, and it starts sending them out. And you don't have to say that it's coming from you. You can say it's coming from Microsoft. You can say it's coming from anyone you want. Now, who's going to track me down? I stopped into a coffee shop. I threw my software on there. I hit my spam button, and I'm gone. I mean, that's an over-exaggeration. You can't do it quite that easily. But a spammer will switch their IP address, will switch their name and everything as quickly as the spam is gone. Or even a little bit deeper into it, they'll watch the SPUs lists and the other lists out there, blacklists, and as soon as the names start to appear on them, they change the address of the sender. Because they're going to get stopped, and of course their ultimate their goal is to get you the spam. We're finding when we first put together our keyword filters that would look for words like adult or porno, and we'd find those words and we'd stop them. Someone suggested ADV in the subject line. Nobody puts ADV in the subject line. And that's the California law. And I guarantee you people in California are getting spammed today. And I would ask you to go and talk to Washington and to the others and ask how well these he mentioned four rules, how are they working? Because my guess is that it's not working very well at all. They're saying right now that 30 to 50% of all corporate email is spam, costing businesses $9 to $15.5 billion a year. And so you have spam software out there that, for instance, bounces the mail. Well, if it's bouncing the spam, doesn't that make it 60% now of your network traffic is taken up by spam? I mean, when you're realizing that you're up against people that will take the word porno and then spell it with zeros instead of O's. So now we have to add a keyword filter that says zeros instead of O's. And so then they put two N's. They're trying everything they can to get past you. Putting your name on an opt-out list may give some spammers an opportunity to go and collect that list and spam it anyway because it's free. I don't have to pay $200 to go buy a list. I can just go to Oregon and I can download it. And these are all good names. I know they're good names. Again, I'm a proponent of this bill. I think that it's a step. But understand that it's not going to be a solution. And a solution might be, we're finding now that if we've got a patent pending on now taking a dictionary. And against keywords, we then throw a dictionary to see how many non-words there are, because that now says it's spam. Is the color red in there? Because 70% of all pornographic email sent has red in it. But you've got to keep building. And now we're building in Bayesian probability filters. And now we're building in categorization filters and content filters that says, he threw her on the bed. Well, all of us can hear that and say, that's adult in context. But guess what? None of those would throw off my keyword filters. So we need something that actually understands and then can discern. So this problem is here to stay. And I think the biggest problem is that the false positives. If Microsoft tightens up their filters, I guarantee they're going to stop good mail. All you have to do is push that button on Microsoft's MSN or Hotmail or whatever, and you're going to block anybody that's not on your friends list. Well, what if somebody sends you a piece of mail that's not on your friends list? You're not going to get it. If a business does that and says if they're not on the friends list, you can't even think of it for business, because businesses get strangers, new customers, if they're lucky, every day sending them mail. So that's not going to solve it either. I think that if you guys could contract with someone, and a company like ours or someone like ours, there'd have to be some liability, again, issues if we do stop something, but it was, good faith. We were trying to stop something, that you're not going to sue us. Right now, if you get this month's PC Magazine, you'll see that there are corporate products that are server-side based, and there are consumer products. And the consumer products, I think, ultimately are the best way, because they give the ultimate decision as to whether something is spam or not to the end user. It ends up in my spam folder, but I look there and I go, you know what? I want stuff from the Disney store. Keep always. And now I'm always going to get that, okay? But if they had stopped it at the server, I would have never known that the Disney store sent me the thing that I asked them to send me. So if you put it there in the consumer's lap, you are going to have the best chance of them not losing anything, but you haven't addressed the problem with the ISP's traffic and all the expense of that coming in. And to do that, what you really need is you need an application that holds all of the rules that I'm mentioning that we're building, but sits in front of the email server. So it actually stops it before it ever hits their network. And that would be a business that would work. But, again, back to false positives. And when we get our Bayesian filters in place, and when we get our content and categorization filters in place, even then we'll be only about 97 or 98% accurate.
To give up with that.
That's all I have to say about that.
That's right.
That download later.
So basically, you're saying, this bill is a direction, right? In someplace in the right direction, it's not going to answer the problem either.
What I'm saying is that if you pass this bill, you will do two things. You will on the bad side of it, I'm afraid, create a list of emails for spammers to harvest for free, for sure. And on the good side of it, you will stop a small percentage of spam coming from legitimate businesses that don't want to be fined. But you will not stop the vast majority of the email that is sent as spam.
And so you're saying the solution is through the consumer. So the consumer has a choice, and if somebody wants to have spam, they can have spam.
Chair, members of the committee, I would say that, you know, if we had our ability to help out, and I know this isn't the place to make sales pitch on this, but I would say...
That's fine. Hey, then go.
We're not on the no-call list, but go ahead.
It's a new type of spam.
What I would suggest is that I read in your bill that for $5 somebody could add their name to the opt-out list and that would be an annual fee and that would be per email address. I would suggest something like entering into... contract with some business doesn't have to be our business. We'd certainly love it, but we would offer our solution as part of your package, and we would monitor it and take care of it. You know, and the product's built. I mean, yeah, we're continually upgrading the filters, but it's built. And so, like a pharmaceutical, we spent all the money and developed it, and now to reproduce it costs us nothing. So for the state of Oregon only.
That quote.
For the state of Oregon only. Okay.
Did he set you up?
Did he just crush it?
Yes, he has an interest in pharmaceutical companies. He probably didn't appreciate that.
We're a good team.
You guys are doing
it. Chair, members of the committee, what I would offer to the committee is that for that $5 fee, our company could certainly keep track of a list of people who want to opt out, and for the same $5, give them a solution that works that they can use on their individual desktops. It would not be available to people outside of Oregon in the same way. I guess they could, but then they're supporting Oregon. Good. Because I think you guys should get some of that, too.
Sure.
Yes, sir.
And if I may just... this, I think, illustrates really rather beautifully the competitive environment that exists for private sector technology solutions to this problem. It is a problem that's being worked on intensively by the large ISPs, by great entrepreneurial startups like this gentleman represents, and that's really the solution. I think the other the liability shield is an extremely important part of helping us to develop and implement that kind of package. But I want to also just underscore the potential perverse effect that my new colleague mentioned just a moment ago, which is this could be the sort of queen of all spam lists here. I mean, all ready to go, just courtesy of the state of Oregon, and the those Nigerian spammers are not going to care one whit that it's intended to achieve exactly the opposite result. Mm-hmm.
Further questions? We've had enough today. It's kind of overload.
Yeah.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question. Mr. Gotz, how many companies are there like yours who have this kind of technology?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we started this and we were going to launch in July of 2001, June of 2001, there were a handful of Unix-based, that means non-Windows, techies that had already solved the problem for the most part at that level. Now it's gotten much worse and spammers are more clever now, but McAfee, who may be represented by somebody in the room right now, who knows, but McAfee purchased SpamKiller from Novasoft in May and launched the product in June, I believe, or in April and launched it in May. Since then, I would guess that there are probably 1,000 companies like mine. If you take a look at PC Magazine, they rated the top 10. And my opinion is that they're all junk because that one handles Outlook, one handles Express, one Eudora, one Netscape. They do 60 to 80% accuracy, et cetera. Nobody has the full solution that we've got right now. I'm confident to say that. And I'll back that up against anybody who will compare, you know, apples to apples.
And the email address is inboxcop.com.
Yeah, and I'm john@geniusemail.com.
Get that down.
Inbox.cop.com. Oh, that's pretty good.
John, we really do appreciate it because, you know, I have to remember, too, that legislators, our level of knowledge is probably about this deep on this subject, and yours is, I mean,
anything that I can do to make myself available, I'll use the phone number.
Okay. Appreciate that.
My husband's a computer programmer. I just say, Steve! And he comes to the rescue. Sometimes he doesn't fix it.
You see, from a consumer standpoint, I mean, that's how they're looking at it.
This is a tough one to fix. And you have to understand, Mr. Chair, that, you know, 3-4 years ago, you may have been able to, this might have worked. I don't know, but it's become so compelling for people because, especially today, if you have a product and you want to market it, dollars are scarce. For $200, you can sandblast 33 million people nonstop. I mean, and the return, you don't think you're going to make $200 back if you send 33 million spams out? You're going to make your money. And that, unfortunately.
How do they figure 3% return?
Oh, if it gets a 1% return, that's 330,000 people, right? Returning.
That's a lot.
You know.
Yeah. It's a lot. Any other questions? Thank you, John. I really appreciate it. And we'll continue to work on this bill. Is anybody else that would like to testify on this bill at this particular time? Opened up a huge box here. Yes. Senator Walker?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like Ms. Pellegrini to just respond to this giant list idea being available to everybody.
Sure, Cheryl. Please come back up. You might as well get all this information out here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. I believe, Senator Walker, that there is technology available to make the list blind so that what happens is that if a person goes to the list, purchases, and signs up, they go to the website. There's a function in the website, a feature at the website, that basically scrubs the spammer's email list of any emails that are contained on our list, but does not show the actual emails to the spammer. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that the list sits there. You can't download the list. You can't incorporate it into your email list. You go to the website, and what the website does is it functions as a scrubber. It just removes those emails from your list, and then you can mail into Oregon. At least that's what I understand is available. I also have a suggestion, since it seems like, I mean, there certainly seems to be a lot of enthusiasm about this subject at this time, and we think that, you know, with this much interest, perhaps much good can come of it. I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you'd be willing to allow us or ask us to convene a work group on a pretty short timeline to meet.
I'm fully in agreement with that. I think you folks need to sit down and talk about the technical aspects of this.
Yeah, there's a...
where we can get to this, because there's evidently constitutional issues that may be involved, and there's the technical issues.
We were contacted by a professor at the University of Oregon in the Information Technology Services. He took a look at our bill, and he actually has a website where he deconstructed our bill, analyzed it from a technical standpoint, made suggestions, and I think that we sure might benefit from maybe asking him to participate in such a group, if that would be amenable.
That's what I would direct, is get your folks together and get industry and yourself. And,
okay.
And if we can find any other interest groups, well, let's, you know, get everybody together and work this thing out. Because it's...
We'd like to have that opportunity, and we specifically want to address Senator Walker's concern. I mean, I just heard about this morning, and somebody said, yeah, you can make the list that way so that the list does not become available to the very people you want to keep the email from. Mm-hmm. But I would need to confirm. I mean, I think I'm pretty sure that that's true, but we'll confirm that the technology exists.
Okay. And Senator Metzger has his company, his other bills, and I think we ought to try and incorporate all this into it. And, mm-hmm. I do know there's some slamming and cramming bills that are being worked in the House. At least that's my understanding. And they're somewhat different. But, by the time we get done with this, we'll have a real education in the world of technology.
Sounds like a rock group.
You did punk rock, yeah.
Slamming, cramming, and family.
Okay, anything else, Cheryl?
No, Mr. Chair, thank you. Okay,
thank
you, members of the committee.
Appreciate
you
coming in. And we'll continue to work on this. Any further questions here? Shut the public hearing on, what was that, Senate Bill 121, was it?
Yes.
And we're not going to work session. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 198. Mr. Dotson.
Senate Bill 198 allows Building Codes Division or appropriate specialty code board to use disciplinary actions from the construction contractors board as basis for disciplinary actions. No fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Okay. Mark. Mark Long, State of Oregon Building Codes Division. Sir. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the
Thank
record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the new administrator of Building Codes Division with the State of Oregon, and I'm here today to talk about our bill, Senate Bill 198. I've provided written testimony for you, which supports Senate Bill 198. Just brief history. Building codes, as you may know, we adopt codes and standards in a variety of areas, primarily electrical, plumbing, mechanical, boiler standards, things like that. We also issue licenses for trades that work in the areas that we regulate, such as electricians, plumbers, folks working in elevators, boilers. Last session, we worked with the Construction Contractors Board, another licensing entity in the state of Oregon, to allow that group to take action when building codes identifies a violation for the areas that we regulate. This bill provides another tool in our toolbox, basically reciprocates that action, and allows us to continue the working relationship we've developed with the Construction Contractors Board over this issue of enforcement, and helps create consistency in our approaches. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, and appreciate your support.
Senator Blair, do you call this bill from the last session, since our resident expert from the Business Committee last go around?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, not specifically, but I know we did some stuff with the CCB last session.
So. Any further questions? Or?
Just one.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Thank you. I feel gaggy today. I don't know why. It must be because I haven't had any sleep. I have a question for you about how you set fees. We have a fee bill coming up, and I'm just kind of curious how it is that a plumber's fee is $250 a year and a stockbroker's fee is only
$15. Sure.
You don't set the stockbroker fees, I understand that, but how do you determine the licensing fees?
Well, we do have plumbers that are stockbrokers. Maybe that's why they can afford it. Senator Walker, we set fees. We have really three different fee sources in Building Codes Division that helps us offset our costs. We set fees for permits for things that we actually do ourselves. We have surcharges for permits that are sold in any of the 132 jurisdictions that are in the state of Oregon that help us support our activities. And then we have license fees. And each of those fees support eight functions within the building codes, or those three sources support eight functions in the Building Codes Division. Some fees are generated through a process with our boards. We have five policy and advisory boards at Building Codes that are made up of electricians, plumbers, structural. And our industry works with us to set those rates to help us carry out those eight functions, which includes things today, which I'm before you, enforcement, licensing, code adoption, interpretations, plan review, inspections, regional local government administration. So it's a variety of mechanisms, and it's based on how our industry customers want to pay for the services that we provide. So I wish there was a simple, easy answer, but it's
well, that was a good answer, and then I have a follow-up, if I might.
Sure.
Would you ever wait almost 40 years before raising a fee, a licensing fee? I want you to take note, because this bill, I have a bill coming forward. Yes. Would you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it would be my goal to not ever have to come before the legislature and ask for fee increases. But that being said.
Let them raise on it.
Yeah. That being said, again, we work. Our fees are directed based on the economy, so we work closely with the construction industry and our partners, and it really depends on what's going on and what services folks are asking for. So I have the fortunate opportunity, or the division does, to come before you every couple sessions to look at fees.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, you're looking at consumer safety, that type of thing.
You bet.
Any further questions? Mm-hmm. Ms. Bell?
I have a building codes bill too coming up.
I can, yeah. I can see the subtle, lobbying that's going on
there. There's no fee.
Okay, so this will allow the reciprocal action by the building codes for violations. Okay. Do you have any further questions on this?
No.
Nope, I guess not. Any further testimony?
Thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you. No further public testimony. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 198 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 198. And the chair would entertain a motion to, or the chair will move Senate Bill 198 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Any objections? So ordered. And anybody have a burning desire to carry this? Nobody, you have a burning desire to carry this?
No. I've been carrying so much I don't want to hear myself speak.
Oh, Carol, carry it. Okay. So, anything else coming for the committee? I didn't put that on. That is not on the consent calendar. We did have a discussion. Maybe we should have that with the committee. We did have a discussion about putting things on the consent calendar. Actually, it takes 2 or 3 days longer to give people time to look at the bill, and so we might as well just have, unless it's really a, give people an opportunity to speak, it will come forth early. So we'll shut the public hearing. Yeah. That's all right. Well, we were close. Come on up.
I guess if we start getting a lot of senators getting verbose on the floor.